Chapter 18, A General Model of the Social Psychology of Labeling. Part 1, The Basic Thesis of the Model. In this paper I am presenting a general model of the social psychology of labeling. That is, the model deals with the psychological, social and social-psychological aspects of the labels that are placed on human beings. The basic idea of the psychological and social impact of labels comes from the critics of psychiatric labels such as Dr. Thomas S. Shash and D. L. Rosenhan, whose ideas are incorporated into sections of this paper, as indicated. These and other individuals argue that psychiatric labels tend to have a negative impact on all concerned. The negative impact can result in a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is probably true in many, but certainly not all cases, and I believe it is only a small part of the picture. The model I am going to develop is more general, more elaborate, and involves the dysfunctional and functional aspects of all types of labels. This includes, but is not limited to, labels associated with occupations, titles, medical conditions, social roles, achievement, lack of achievement, as well as psychiatric conditions. Thus, the thesis is very different from the relatively simple concept of the critical view of psychiatric labels. The basic thesis of this paper is presented in the following list form, and it may not be totally understood until the later paragraphs are read, which describes the fundamental premises in detail. The following can also be thought of as an outline or summary of the paper. Labels have four primary components, which are the defining component, the psychological component, the social component, and social psychological component, which can have an impact on the labeled individual that is independent of any realities that the label may represent. A label may have functional or dysfunctional consequences, depending on the circumstances. Labels can represent realities and/or delineate fantasies, superstitions, and other erroneous beliefs as if they were realities. A label can also represent a subjective assessment, which may be conveyed with the aid of the label as if it was an absolute scientific assessment of reality. We are all labeled, with a number of labels, by the people in our social environment, by the roles we take on, and by our own thinking, actions, and verbal remarks. Note: the following is discussed in Part 2 under the heading Additional Ideas of the General Model of the Social Psychology of Labeling. Labels have schemas associated with them. When people hear about an individual's label, they can make a logical or semi-logical or irrational evaluation based on the label. Labels and their associated schemas have a suggestive influence on human beings, which can range in strength from very great to zero, and can guide thinking and behavior in a way that can range from rational to irrational. Labels have an intended utility, which is the defining function of the label. The basic five factors that apply to labels: the defining component or utility, the psychological component, the social component, the social-psychological component, and suggestive influence also apply to all entities and events that involve human interaction. The items an individual owns and the events an individual gets involved with can lead to labeling of the individual. The four components of a label: the defining component, the psychological component, the social component, and social-psychological component, and some of the other concepts of the thesis will be briefly explained in the remainder of this section. Additional ideas that relate to the basic thesis will be presented in Part 2 of this paper. The defining component of a label delineates or describes something that relates to the individual, such as behavior, intelligence, strength, occupation, or the social, psychological, psychiatric, or medical condition of the individual. The psychological component of a label is the impact that the label has on the individual's psychological adjustment, mental state, thinking, perceptions, responses, and behavior. The social component is the effect that the individual's label has on other people in relation to the way the labeled individual is treated by others as a direct or indirect result of the label. That is, this component relates to the social consequences for the labeled individual, which result from his or her label. This means that an individual might be treated in a specific way because of the way he or she is labeled. The social psychological component is the psychological impact on the labeled individual as a result of the social component mentioned above. That is, it is basically the psychological effect that manifests from the way the labeled individual is treated by society as a result of his or her label. The treatment can range from highly positive to severely negative depending on the label. This also involves the labeled individual's perceptions and interpretations of the treatment, which has an impact on the individual's mental state, emotional reactions, adjustment and perceptions. The relative impact of the psychological, social and social psychological components of a label as it is applied to an individual under a given set of circumstances can range in strength from very strong to zero. Very strong means that the component has a very strong and significant impact. Zero means the component has no impact. The impact also has a relative degree of positivity or negativity, which can range from very positive desirable to very negative undesirable. It should be understood that these three components of a given label may not all have the same strength. For example, the psychological component of a label might be very weak and somewhat negative, the social component might be moderately strong and positive, and the social psychological component might be weak and positive. It is not important whether the above combination can actually exist with a real individual with a label. However, it is important to understand that the components of a label can have different degrees of impact, which can even involve some components being positive and some negative. The phrase that appeared in the thesis sentence, "the realities that the label delineates," embodies a very important concept. Labels often delineate accurate or semi-accurate realities, such as a person's physical or mental handicap, the medical condition of a patient, an individual's occupation, a person's ability in a specific area, an individual's weakness in relation to certain activities, etc. Of course, these realities can have an impact on the individual that is independent of the label, which can be of a psychological, social, and social psychological nature. That is, just as a label can produce a psychological, social, and social psychological impact, so can the reality produce its own psychological, social and social psychological impact. What was stated in the previous paragraph about the relative strength of the impact of labels and its positivity or negativity also applies to the impact produced by the reality. Thus, it is important to understand that the impact from the label and the impact from the reality are two distinct sets of factors and should not be confused. In addition, there may be some significant impact from the reality itself, which is essentially not of a psychological, social or social psychological nature. An example will clarify the above. If an individual is mentally retarded and is not labeled as such, there still will be a psychological, social and social psychological impact as a result of the intellectual weaknesses that comprise mental retardation. This impact would be in addition to the problems produced directly by the mental disability, such as an inability to read, write, and adequately carry out certain basic personal care functions. If such an individual is eventually labeled as retarded, the label will have its own independent psychological, social, and social psychological components. A functional label for a negative condition, such as the mental disability mentioned above, would reduce or eliminate the negative psychological, social, and social psychological impact that results from the actual condition and guides the individual toward constructive treatment of the condition. Such a label may also inform others what are appropriate and inappropriate expectations of the labeled individual, which may reduce the negative social impact of the individual's condition. Thus, a functional label for a negative condition reduces the problems associated with the condition. A dysfunctional label for a negative condition does just the opposite of the above. That is, a dysfunctional label would increase or create one or more negative impacts, which could be of a psychological, social and or social psychological nature. A label can also be defined as dysfunctional if it does not guide the individual toward optimum corrective action or treatment, or if it guides the individual toward inappropriate or dysfunctional treatment. A functional label for a positive condition, such as a specific occupation or ability, will guide the individual toward appropriate roles and actions to make maximum use of his occupational position or ability. Functional labels also inform others on how to interact with an individual. Some examples are as follows. If someone is labeled chief executive officer, president, or boss, we know that they are to be treated with respect and they may have power over our employment and occupational advancement. If someone is labeled teacher, professor, PhD, or highly intelligent, we know that we can obtain certain types of information and guidance from them. Dysfunctional labels for a positive condition are essentially just the opposite of the above. It does not provide information needed for optimum and or proper interaction. Another important idea of the thesis of this paper is that some labels represent little or no reality. That is, labels can sometimes delineate fantasies, superstitions and other erroneous beliefs as if they were realities. For example, if an individual is labeled with a term suggesting that the individual is possessed by the devil or by evil spirits, the label is of this nature. However, such labels still can have very significant psychological, social and social-psychological impacts. For example, people have been executed because of superstitious or erroneous labels, such as in the Salem witch trials of the late 1600s. There have also been people who became powerful and famous because they had positive labels of an erroneous or superstitious nature attached to them, such as divine, holy, saint or labels that conveyed supernatural powers. The point is that a label does not have to represent any reality for it to have a psychological, social, and social-psychological impact. Some labels are very subjective in nature. For example, if someone is labeled good, bad, kind, evil, etc., the label is quite subjective. One person's definition of a good person might be another person's definition of an evil person. However, subjective labels, whether they are positive, neutral or negative, have their own psychological, social, and social-psychological impact, just as if the label represented an absolute scientific reality. Thus, labels tend to have impacts whether they are positive, neutral, negative, true, false or superstitious in nature. The psychological, social and social-psychological components can have a major impact on the way the labeled individual functions in society and the type of life that the individual lives. This applies to all of us, because we are all labeled. People in our environment observe our physical structure, behavior, achievements, failures, social status, mental and physical health, and they put labels on us. We also put labels on ourselves by the way we behave and interact with others. This includes the type of roles we take on and the type of occupation we choose. We may also label ourselves by telling others about our label, which can be done indirectly or directly. For example, we can tell others directly that we are a baseball fan, a movie enthusiast, a single person, a married person, a photographer, a Republican, a Democrat, etc. If we tell a person we are smart, intelligent, creative, kind, etc., we might prefer to do it indirectly, to avoid being labeled conceited. This indirect communication can involve talking about related experiences that will convey the message that we are labeled in a certain way. For example, an individual who wants to convey the idea that she is labeled intelligent might talk about experiences that relate to school. Another way people often intentionally label themselves is with documentation. For example, when an individual attends school to obtain a degree, with the aim of using the diploma to obtain employment or advanced education, the individual is in the process of creating a label for herself. People often hang such documentation: bachelor degree, master's degree, diplomas and PhD certifications on their walls, in an effort to label themselves as indicated by their diplomas in the minds of others. Some people with disabling medical conditions may go to their doctor to obtain written documents labeling them disabled, such as for obtaining disability benefits or to be excused from military service. Thus, we often label ourselves intentionally and unintentionally, but we are often labeled by others. When other people label us, one of two basic processes are generally involved. One is conscious labeling and the other is unconscious labeling. That is, people label others either consciously or unconsciously, which is discussed in the following three paragraphs. Consciously labeling another person involves deliberately analyzing and/or evaluating the individual with the intention of labeling him or her. At the simplest level, this type of labeling may be done in a casual and unscientific way in the evaluator's mind. However, This type of labeling can be more sophisticated and might involve carefully carried out interviews and/or testing in some cases to determine the appropriate label. It can involve careful observations of the individual to obtain information needed for the labeling. After enough information is gathered, then a label may be applied. This more sophisticated version of conscious labeling is the method that scientists, psychologists, psychiatrists, and physicians evaluating abnormal physiological conditions use when they label a person. Unconscious labeling involves a casual and unintentional process and is more or less the opposite of the above. It does not involve deliberate evaluation and analyzing. The person that labels another unconsciously usually has no deliberate intention of labeling anyone. Unconscious labeling takes place when one individual obtains information about another individual by observation, interaction, or from other sources. The information is usually obtained in a casual and unintentional way, which often involves various types of face-to-face interaction. Some examples will clarify the process of unconscious labeling. If we interact with a hypothetical person named John, we may consistently perceive him as a kind individual. Thus, the label kind will be associated with John in our minds. We may tell other people that John is kind, which will spread the label to other people's consciousness. Another example is if we talk to a hypothetical person named Susan, we may obtain certain information during the conversation that result in unconscious labeling. Susan may reveal the way she labeled herself. She may say that she has a master's degree. Then we may associate the label master's degree with Susan. She may say, "I am a teacher," then we may associate the label teacher with Susan. We may taste Susan's cooking and decide she is a very good cook. Then the label good cook will be associated with Susan in our mind. We may also notice during the conversation that Susan is a very friendly person. Then we may associate the label friendly person with Susan. It should be understood that the above does not suggest that conscious labeling is necessarily more accurate than unconscious labeling. Either method can have an accuracy ranging from very great to zero. Of course, consciously labeling someone in a sophisticated way is probably more accurate on the average. However, such methods have been known to result in erroneous labels, which will be seen later in this text when the D.L. Rosenhan's research is discussed. Thus, we intentionally and unintentionally label ourselves, and people consciously and unconsciously label us. The question to keep in mind in the labeling process is, how are we labeling ourselves and how are we labeling other individuals? And what are the consequences of the labeling? That is, what are the psychological, social and social-psychological impacts of the labels we are applying to ourselves and to other people? Part 2: Additional Ideas of the General Model of the Social Psychology of Labeling. Labels have schemas associated with them. That is, when an individual hears or reads about a label, a list of information and ideas associated with the label are activated within the mind. The information and ideas that an individual associates with a specific label can include one or more of the following: scientific information, rational ideas, irrational ideas, erroneous ideas, logical associations, prejudicial beliefs, superstitions, religious beliefs, philosophical beliefs, irrational associations, emotional feelings and responses. It is important to understand that each individual is likely to have a somewhat different schema associated with a specific label. Labels that are highly scientific might elicit almost identical schemas in the minds of scientists, but this is not the case with most labels that are applied to human beings. We can look at labels and the information and ideas associated with them from a slightly different angle than the above, which is as follows. Labels can provide information about an individual, which can range from highly accurate to completely inaccurate. When people learn about an individual's label, there can be a logical or semi-logical or irrational evaluation based on the label. The results of such an evaluation is partly determined by the relative degree of accuracy of the label, the skill of the evaluator, and the time and effort the evaluator invests in the evaluation. There is more to labels and the schemas associated with them than the above would suggest. Labels and their associated schemas have a suggestive influence on human beings, which can range in strength from very great to zero. That is, in general, a label can have suggestive influence over the labeled individual and the people who know of the individual's label. The suggestive influence can guide thinking and behavior in a way that can range from rational to irrational. The resulting behavior and thinking can also range from highly functional to completely dysfunctional, which depends on the label, the people involved, and the social and psychological conditions. The suggestive influence in general can be seen as part of the psychological, social or social-psychological components of a label. The above is more understandable when we consider that the suggestive influence does not involve logical thinking and evaluation. It involves a type of non-logical thinking and responding, which may also involve emotional reactions and responses, in some cases. Much of the suggestive influence involves relatively simple thinking that may be based on simple associations, which may or may not be rational. Thus, labels have psychological, social and social-psychological components, in addition to a suggestive influence. The suggestive influence can have intellectual and emotional factors. This can guide behavior in a way that can range from rational to irrational, which can be functional or dysfunctional. In addition, a label has an intended utility, which is the defining function of the label. An interesting observation can be made here. If the underlined words in the above paragraph are examined, these words represent the major factors of labels and are the psychological component, the social component, the social-psychological component, suggestive influence, and intended utility. It turns out that these five factors apply to all entities and situations, not just labels. That is, these five factors apply to any object or event that involves human interactions. If we can understand this general principle about all entities and situations that involve human interaction, we can understand labels and their manifestations better, which is the reason for this diversion from the primary topic. Some examples will clarify this important principle, which are presented in the following four paragraphs, with the five primary factors underlined. If an individual buys a new luxury car, it will have a psychological impact on the buyer. For example, the buyer might feel better about himself because of the luxury associated with the car. He might also feel more relaxed because he does not have to ride crowded public transportation to and from his workplace. The car will also have a social and social-psychological impact. To clarify further, the social impact might involve making new friends, because people see the driver as a high-status person with an expensive car. The perception of high status, resulting from the ownership of the car, can trigger many positive associations in the minds of some people. The car owner may also make new friends because people may want transportation. The social psychological impact in this example is the way the car owner responds to the above increase in the friendliness of others, which resulted from the ownership of the car. The car also has a suggestive influence on the owner and other people, which will guide behavior to some degree. The car has its obvious utility of transportation. A simple toy, such as a ball, can have a significant psychological, social and social-psychological impact for the child that owns it. The psychological component involves the development of skills and coordination and satisfaction as a result of playing with the ball. The social component involves making new friends as a result of playing ball with others. The social-psychological component involves the child's response and adjustments that result from the social component, which are the friends and their reaction to the child with the ball. This can involve the praise or criticism the child received from others as he was playing ball with friends. This will involve emotional adjustment and learning appropriate roles and status, particularly in relation to playing ball. If the child was a good ball player, he probably received much praise from others, which can facilitate the development of self-confidence and a positive self-image. If the child was a poor ball player, he probably received criticism from the other players, which will facilitate the development of a lack of self-confidence and a negative self-image. Owning the ball and all of the manifestations that result from owning it can have a suggestive influence on behavior and thinking. The child might want to play ball as soon as he sees the ball. The child's friends might also want to play ball as soon as they see the child with the ball. The child might even want to play ball when he has schoolwork to do, without thinking about the consequences. The utility of the ball is a toy that provides exercise and can be used to play competitive games. A wedding is a good example of an event with a significant psychological, social and social-psychological component for the bride and groom. Such an event also usually has a strong suggestive influence for the individuals that are about to be married. The details of the above are long and obvious, and I will not discuss them. The utility of the event is to celebrate, take marriage vows, and to declare to all present that the couple will be married. A person's job can also have a significant psychological, social and social-psychological impact. The exact nature of such an impact depends on the specific job and work environment. A job can also have a suggestive influence on the worker and the people who know the worker. The utility of the job for the worker may be just to earn money. Another interesting observation can be made, if the examples presented in the four preceding paragraphs are examined, which are a luxury car, a ball, a wedding and a job. All of these items can lead to the development of one or more labels for the individuals who are involved with the items. The person who buys the luxury car may be labeled as a car owner, a luxury car owner, a rich person with a luxury car, a high-status person with an expensive car, a friendly person who drives his friends to work, an unfriendly person who will not drive friends and acquaintances anywhere, a snob who will not allow acquaintances in his luxury car. The child who owns the ball can be labeled a ball owner, a good ball player, a poor ball player, a friendly person who owns a ball, an unfriendly person who will not share his ball with others. The wedding will result in the man being labeled a groom, a husband, and maybe ultimately a father. The woman will be labeled a bride, a wife, and maybe ultimately a mother. The job may result in the worker being labeled according to an occupational role or title, such as a lawyer, doctor, or policeman. The job can also result in being labeled a good worker, a poor worker, or an employee. All of the above labels, or any label that results from the ownership of an item or the involvement with an entity or event, will have a psychological, a social, and a social-psychological component, which may or may not be significant. The labels that result from the above process can also have a suggestive influence on behavior. These labels, just like any other label, have a utility, which is its defining component. That is, the labels clearly define something about the individual, which is the utility of a label. Thus, the general principle to keep in mind is that owning an item or interacting with an entity or an event can lead to labeling. This labeling does not always happen, and it sometimes may happen at an insignificant level. If you own an item that does not have much significance to the people in your environment, you are not likely to be labeled as a result. For example, nobody will probably label you for owning a pencil, because it is not very significant from the point of view of others. However, you probably would be labeled if you owned an airplane, because this has some social significance. If you own an entire airline, you almost certainly will be labeled with a number of labels, because this has a great deal of social significance. Now that the basic concepts of the thesis have been delineated in parts 1 and 2, I will go into more detail about the four components of a label in the remainder of this paper. Each component will be discussed in a separate part of this paper as follows: the defining component and related ideas in part 3, the psychological component and related ideas in part 4, the social component in part 5, and the social-psychological component in part 6. Under these sections, some of the ideas already presented will be repeated and elaborated on in greater detail. Part 3, the defining component and related ideas. The defining function of a label describes or delineates something about a person, which may be accurate, partly accurate, completely inaccurate, superstitious, positive, neutral or negative. Labels are used to delineate a person's occupation, title, medical condition, degree of intelligence, mental status, and just about any condition, behavior or quality that can be associated with an individual that has relevance to others. Usually labels are used to describe or delineate something about a person that has significance to society or other people that interact with the labeled individual. For example, it is significant to others if an individual is labeled a murderer, a holy person, the boss, a police officer, insane, a cancer patient. Thus, the defining component gives us information about how to interact with the labeled person. With the murderer, we will be cautious and avoid being in the same space as she is occupying, unless we are law enforcement officers. We may go to the holy person for religious advice and ceremonies. We follow the orders of the boss. We go to a police officer for protection from criminal behavior, and we make sure we are not violating the law when we see a police officer. This may mean that we slow our automobiles down to the legal speed limit when we see an individual that has the symbolic indications of the label police officer. We know that we should not take the person labeled insane very seriously, and we also know that such an individual may be quite irrational, irresponsible, and unpredictable. The person labeled cancer patient has a label that is significant to the medical personnel who must treat the patient. This label also has significance for insurance companies and the friends and family of the patient, who may be providing financial assistance, comfort, and sympathy for the ailing individual. Sadly, this label may also have significance because insurance companies, employers, and acquaintances might want to avoid dealing with the problems of an individual labeled cancer patient. If a condition or a factor associated with a person does not have significance to society or other people in the social environment, it is not likely to be labeled. For example, there is no label for a person who has an inconspicuous birthmark, even if it is known to exist by doctors, family, and friends. An individual that behaves in a harmless but odd way in private will most likely not be labeled, even if she tells others of the odd behavior, because her behavior has no significance to other people. Of course, doing the same odd behavior in public, even if it is harmless, might result in a label, such as crazy or mentally ill, because public behavior has some significance to society. The individual may also apply labels to himself or herself. However, even when the individual applies a label to the self, it is likely to be based on what the society believes to be important. This is because the individual is a member of society and he or she shares the culture, norms, values, and beliefs of the society. The labels that result from the self-labeling process can be divided into three basic categories, which are 1. Totally private label, 2. An informal public label, 3. A formally documented label. These three categories will be discussed in the following 4 paragraphs. The totally private label is a descriptive designation that the individual places on himself or herself without any intention of telling anybody about the label. Perhaps in some cases the individual might reveal the label he or she placed on the self to some family members, close friends, or therapists. However, such disclosures would not be done regularly and it would not be done to persuade others to accept the label, and if it is, then it would not fit the definition of a totally private label, as the concept is defined for this text. Totally private labeling is often done unconsciously as we think about our abilities, weaknesses, goals, and desires. That is, as people think about certain qualities in relation to themselves, they more or less label themselves. For example, some people will decide that they are highly intelligent and they may privately label themselves accordingly. And some individuals may decide that they are lacking in intelligence or are average and may privately label themselves in such a way. An informal public label is when an individual privately labels herself and then directly or indirectly tells others about the label, or conveys the basic ideas that relate to the label to other people. Using the example of intelligence, if the individual decides that she is somewhat unintelligent, she may convey the idea to others, which may be done to avoid intellectually challenging situations that are likely to lead to failures. It may also be done to avoid the misunderstandings and embarrassment that may result from such failures. A formally documented label is a label that an individual intentionally obtains or applies to the self with the help of documentation. Examples are as follows. An individual may spend many years in school to obtain the label PhD, which is documented with the PhD Certificate of Certification. Similar examples include high school diplomas, bachelor degrees, and master's degrees. An individual may label herself disabled and obtain certifying documentation from her physicians, such as to obtain disability benefits. Formally documented labels are usually the most important of the three types of labels, followed by an informal public label. The totally private label is usually the least important label. There are, of course, many other types of labels and variations in the way they can be categorized. This includes labels based on superstitions, fantasies, and other erroneous beliefs held by a group or the entire society. That is, people can be labeled based on some type of erroneous belief that is part of the belief system of a society. Thus, when such beliefs are associated with an individual in certain social environments, the individual will be labeled accordingly. Whether or not a label represents reality or fantasy does not necessarily diminish the impacts of its psychological component, its social component, and its social-psychological component, which will become more apparent in the paragraphs that follow. Part 4, the psychological component and related ideas. The psychological component is the impact that the label has on the individual's thinking, learning, behavior, perceptions, and emotional states. Since everyone has their own unique psychological makeup, it certainly does not follow that two individuals with the same label will have similar psychological responses to the label. It is, of course, possible that in some cases there certainly may be similar psychological responses, but in other cases there may be great differences between the way individuals respond to their identical labels. Some people may not even have any psychological reaction to a label, and another individual's thinking, learning, behavior, perceptions, and emotional states may be greatly influenced or changed by the same label. In addition, people with the same label might respond in ways that are very different, such as functional, dysfunctional, no psychological response, happy, depressed, displaying specific behavioral responses, etc. Of course, we might be able to make some reasonably good guesses on the way people on the average might respond to different labels placed on them. This is done with the examples of the psychological component of labels in this subsection. However, it should be understood that the general model presented in this paper does not attempt to predict the exact nature of the psychological component for specific labels. It just states that a label has a psychological component, which can range in strength from very strong to zero. Very strong means here that the psychological component of the label has a great influence on the individual's psychological adjustment, thinking, learning, behavior, perceptions, responses, and emotional states. Zero means that there is no influence or impact from the label on psychological adjustment, thinking, learning, behavior, perceptions, responses, and emotional states. The concept of the psychological component can be clarified with some examples, which follow. However, the ideas presented in the above paragraph should be kept in mind when reading the material that follows. A good example to illustrate the psychological component is the label intelligent. If someone is labeled intelligent, he will probably develop a high self-esteem, be confident, and may take on challenging intellectual activities. If the individual who has been labeled intelligent finds a specific task difficult, he may attribute the difficulty to the task, as opposed to attributing it to lack of personal ability. This may result in a persistent effort to master the task. An individual who was labeled as unintelligent, stupid, or lacking in intelligence may respond and behave just the opposite as the above. That is, he might develop a low self-esteem, lack confidence especially in relation to academic activities, attribute difficult tasks to lack of ability, give up easily, and avoid intellectual and academic pursuits. This might even happen if the person in reality has excellent intellectual abilities. If the individual is lacking in intellectual abilities, but is within the normal range of intelligence, the problem will probably be made worse by the label unintelligent or stupid. Probably the labels that will produce the strongest psychological component are labels that are associated directly or indirectly with a psychiatric diagnosis, such as mental patient, mentally ill, a clinically depressed person, schizophrenic, manic depressive, etc. The word indirectly was used in the above sentence to imply that there may be additional labeling by family and friends of the patient as well as other laymen as a result of the psychiatric diagnostic label. The most obvious examples of such labels are crazy, nuts, insane, a madman, etc. This labeling process, carried out by laymen, could also be precipitated by the reality associated with the abnormal behavior of a psychiatric patient. However, whatever the reason for the label or the source of the label, it is likely to have a significant psychological impact on the labeled individual. For example, a person that has been labeled as a clinically depressed individual may learn to attribute his dissatisfaction with a specific situation or with life in general as a result of an illness, which may not really exist. This may not happen at first, but the patient may learn to attribute all his dissatisfactions to a sickness. Many would argue, such as Dr. Thomas S. Shash, that there is no illness involved. Perhaps in certain cases there is a true biochemical sickness causing the problem, but this is probably rare. In most cases of depression, the patient probably has a more or less legitimate dissatisfaction with certain aspects of his or her life circumstances. Attributing the depression to an illness, which may not exist, may discourage the individual from making constructive changes in his life. The patient that is convinced that his depression is caused by an illness has no reason to try to determine what he is unhappy about and make the needed changes. In many cases, the patient probably was originally quite aware of the cause of his depressed feelings, but the diagnostic label might convince them that the real cause is an illness. That is, the patient may be convinced, perhaps with the help of his doctor in some cases, that the sadness is all coming from internal sources, such as irrational thinking or an abnormal biochemistry. This may sometimes in fact be the case, but probably more often it is not the primary or only cause. Thus, the psychological component of the label associated with depression might reduce or eliminate any motivation the patient had to make constructive changes in life, and result in attributing their sadness to a non-existent disease. However, the label might guide the individual towards psychiatric treatment, which may prevent the problem from worsening, or it might result in an improvement in the overall condition. That is, whether such a label has negative or positive consequences would depend on the individual and the people in his environment. Note, the primary cause of depression and related conditions, I believe, is usually not caused by a biological disease or triggered by biological factors, as some psychiatrists believe. My theory is it is the result of a failure of the individual to satisfy his major needs. This is probably often coupled with maladaptive coping strategies, which includes certain thinking patterns. According to this theory, everyone has different major needs. When one or more of such needs are not satisfied, or stop being satisfied, the individual will become depressed if he perceives no chance of changing the circumstances to satisfy the need S. If there is an ongoing challenging struggle to satisfy the need, even if the effort is only slightly successful, it will probably reduce the chances of depression developing or reduce the severity of the condition. For example, if a man is divorced, he will become seriously depressed if he had a major need to be married to his wife and he perceives no chance of getting back with her, and does not believe he can satisfy his major need in another way. That is, he gives up trying to satisfy his major need, because he believes it is impossible or far too difficult to satisfy. The depressed state that develops could eventually result in a dysfunctional biochemical impact on the nervous system, which perhaps is equivalent to an illness. However, the condition was not caused by this dysfunctional biochemical manifestation, but it might worsen or perpetuate the condition. If the unsatisfied need was not a major one, or if the individual believed he was going to find an alternative way to satisfy it, the individual would probably not become depressed in the psychiatric sense, according to this model. This would probably be especially true if the individual found the situation somewhat challenging and put up a struggle that was partly successful. Of course, such an individual may display the normal types of sad feelings that people experience during unpleasant periods of life. End of note. In general, psychiatric diagnostic labels can have a very strong psychological component. Such a component can manifest in a loss of confidence, a withdrawal from social interactions, and the development of psychological problems that may worsen the condition of the patient. However, in some cases the psychiatric labels may have a beneficial psychological result. Beneficial results from psychological labels are probably more likely to result when the condition is severe or when the psychiatric disorder is truly the result of a physiological disease. In such cases, the label might serve to excuse the patient for his abnormal responses and disabilities that result from the condition. The label might guide the behavior of the individual toward proper treatment of his condition. Psychiatric labels also usually have strong social components, which is discussed in the next subheading. Part 5. The social component and related ideas. The social component is the component of a label that has social impact, and it relates to the way an individual will be treated by others as a result of the label he or she has. That is, the social component is the way the label influences the responses of others in relation to the labeled individual. Still another way of stating this is a label can influence the way people think about, interact with, and respond to an individual, which is the social component of the label. In a sense, the social component is analogous to the psychological component that was already discussed under the previous subheading. The social component relates to the response of society in relation to the labeled individual. The psychological component relates to the response of the individual in relation to his or her own label, and just as the psychological component can vary greatly with the same label placed on different individuals, so can the social component. The reaction various people have to an individual with a specific label will not necessarily be the same. For example, an individual with the label police officer might be respected, liked, and treated in a very desirable way by some people. However, other people might fear and dislike the individual labeled police officer. This may result in unpleasant treatment for the police officer. In extreme cases, the treatment can result in personal injury or death. This can happen strictly because of the label and nothing more in some cases. Thus, a label can have a very strong impact on the way an individual is treated by others. A person can be loved, honored, rewarded, ignored, penalized, tortured, or killed just because of the label he or she has. This suggests a tremendous variation in the relative impact and nature of a label's social component. Just as with the psychological component, this model does not predict the exact nature of the social component of a label. It just states that a label has a social component, which can range in strength from very strong to zero. Very strong means the label has a great influence on the way others treat the labeled individual. Zero means that the label has no impact or influence on the way the labeled individual is treated. However, just as was done with the psychological component, it is possible to make some good guesses on the way people will treat others with specific labels. But there is also some good experimental evidence on how people respond to the social component of some labels. The experimental evidence will be presented after some examples on the way most people are likely to respond to certain common labels. The social component can be easily seen in the way people are likely to treat a person labeled highly intelligent. They may attribute many positive qualities to the individual, which he or she may or may not have. That is, a label that is generally perceived by society to be positive may tend to result in perceptions of other positive qualities, which the labeled individual may or may not have. This is a very important property of positive labels, and it is called the halo effect. Partly as a result of the above, the individual labeled intelligent will probably be respected more than others, may be given special privileges, and her actions, achievements, and failures will be interpreted in terms of the label. If the individual fails at a task, the interpretation of others might be that the task was unreasonably difficult, the individual did not apply herself, or that the individual was lazy. If an individual with the label intelligent constantly fails, people may think she is lazy, or is suffering from a psychological or psychiatric disorder that is interfering with success. In general, failures or misbehaviors that are obvious and very significant might have a worse impact on an individual that has one or more highly positive labels. For example, a person that is obviously dishonest, deviant, and steals will be considered even more negative by others if she is also labeled intelligent. Thus, positive labels do not automatically lead to praise and rewards from society. The individual labeled intelligent may be worked harder during the school years. Parents and teachers may expect more from the child and adolescent that is labeled intelligent. If the expectations are not met, punishment may be inflicted on the labeled individual. However, there are probably far more rewards than penalties involved with positive labels, such as intelligent. If an individual labeled intelligent is reasonably successful, her negative qualities will probably be less noticeable by the people she interacts with. This can be thought of as the result of the halo effect discussed above. The label of stupid or unintelligent or its equivalent would probably have a social component that is more or less the opposite of the above example. The individual may be perceived as having many negative traits by others, regardless of whether the individual truly has such traits. In general, there is a tendency, which is not absolute, for people to perceive many negative traits in an individual labeled with a negative label, regardless of whether the individual has such traits. This tendency has been called the fork-tailed effect, or the negative halo effect. This may also make it difficult for others to perceive the positive qualities of the individual who is labeled with a negative label such as unintelligent. The person labeled as unintelligent may be excused for doing poor work, which will be more likely to be the case if the individual appears to be working hard. This is especially likely to be true when the individual is attending school. People, especially instructors and parents, might be more lenient with a child or adolescent that is labeled unintelligent in certain areas. The assumption is that such an individual simply is not capable of succeeding, especially in school. This assumption in some cases might be quite true, but in most cases it probably is untrue and the assumption is dysfunctional in such cases. Thus, sometimes a negative label can give an individual some freedom and relief from the norms and requirements of the society. This may in fact be functional and justifiable in some cases, especially if the negatively labeled individual truly cannot meet the standards, such as with a mentally retarded individual. However, in many cases, a negative label resulted from dysfunctional behavior patterns that were learned. The unintelligent individual in some cases may have learned to avoid studying and attending school regularly. Such individuals may come from a poverty-stricken and culturally deprived environment. In such cases, the freedom provided by a negative label, such as unintelligent, can be quite dysfunctional, unless corrective educational goals and methods are provided. As already stated, there is some research that shows the social component of labels. The researchers obviously were not working with the general model I am presenting in this paper, and they were not trying to demonstrate the social components of labels. They were essentially evaluating prejudice and the dysfunctional effects of psychiatric diagnostic labels. However, from the perspective of the general model of the social psychology of labeling, the social components and related consequences and dynamics are revealed by the research which follows. An interesting experiment that demonstrates the social component of a label was carried out by Philip Goldberg in 1968. He actually wanted to evaluate whether females were biased in their evaluations of other females. The experimenter presented a series of professional journal articles to a number of female college students. The subjects were supposed to rate the articles for persuasiveness, style, and competence. The experimenter presented the same articles to the subjects with either false male authors or false female authors. When the articles had male names printed on them as authors, the subjects rated the articles higher than when female authors were printed on the articles. From the perspective of the general model of social psychology of labeling, the above can be explained as follows. The masculine names elicited in the minds of the subjects the label male author, which had a positive suggestive influence that resulted in a higher rating. When the female names were put on the articles, the label female author was elicited in the minds of the subjects. The feminine label apparently had a negative suggestive influence, because they rated the articles lower than when male names were on the same articles. Another experiment that also shows the social component of gender-related labels was carried out by Berna Skripnik and Mark Schneider in 1982. A female was paired with one male in each experimental trial. However, both subjects did not know the true gender of their partner. That is, the female and the male subjects never saw each other or heard each other's voice during the experiment. They were put in separate rooms. The subjects communicated with each other through a special communication system that consisted of a series of lights. The subjects were told that they must decide who will do various tasks that the experimenter designated. They were to do this by discussion and negotiation by communicating with their partner through the system of lights. Some of these tasks were traditionally performed by males, such as fixing a switch, others were neutral, and some were traditionally performed by females, such as cooking. The rules set by the experimenter give the man greater initiative in the bargaining process. The idea of the experiment was to manipulate the male subject's beliefs by telling them that their unseen partners were either a typical man or a typical woman, which are labels. The female subject was not told anything about the partner or the experiment. When the label typical woman was applied, the male subject selected the masculine tasks and left the female tasks for the woman. When the label typical man was applied, the tasks were more randomly divided amongst both partners. The results of the above are certainly not surprising. The males were college students and they were probably using the assumption that a typical woman would be more skilled in performing tasks that females traditionally perform. They probably felt that their skills in performing such tasks were inadequate. They also probably felt that they could carry out the tasks traditionally performed by males much better than a typical woman could. The above experiment was carried on to a second phase. The second phase of the Bernoulli-Skripnik and Mark Snyder experiment involved changing the bargaining power in relation to choosing the tasks. In this phase of the experiment, the women had more control over choosing the tasks than the men did. Women that were labeled as typical women, in the first part of the experiment, behaved as typical women would behave, and they chose tasks that are traditionally performed by females. However, women that were treated like males, as a result of the labeling process in the first part of the experiment, behaved less like typical women. They chose more male tasks than the women that were labeled as typical women. This shows the social psychological component of the label, which will be discussed in more detail in part 6 of this paper. The basic idea is the way an individual is labeled and treated by others affects the individual's thinking and behavior. In this experiment, the behavior that was influenced by the masculine label resulted in the women displaying choices that were less likely to be associated with typical women. And the women that were labeled with the feminine label behaved as the label, typical women, would predict. Gender labels are commonly used in our society and the above experiments are interesting, but the results are not really surprising. Experiments that involved psychiatric labels produced results that were more astonishing than the experiments involving gender labels. The labels with the most dramatic negative social components are probably psychiatric diagnostic labels and the layman's version of these labels. Obvious examples are schizophrenic, manic depressive, mentally ill, crazy, nuts, etc. There is good research dealing with psychiatric labels. This research was carried out by D.L. Rosenhan dealing with the reactions of the staff in psychiatric hospitals to patients who falsely and secretly obtained formal admission to the psychiatric wards by mimicking a symptom of schizophrenia. The phrase phony patients and pseudopatients will be used as synonyms in this text. Actually, the phony patients only stated that they heard voices, which is a symptom of schizophrenia. When they were asked what the voices were saying, their answers were empty, hollow, and thud, and they indicated that the voices were unfamiliar and were the same sex as they were. After the pseudopatients were admitted to the psychiatric hospital, they behaved in a way that was totally normal. In fact, the phony patients were told in advance by the experimenter that they were to try to be discharged from the psychiatric hospital by behaving in a normal way, with the goal of convincing the hospital staff that they were sane. Failure to follow such orders would increase the stay at the mental hospital, which was unpleasant for the pseudopatients. Thus, the phony patients were motivated to behave in a normal way. Hence, the pseudopatients indicated that they did not hear any more voices and felt fine after they were admitted to the psychiatric hospital, as they were instructed to do by the experimenter. The phony patients did display some genuine mild nervousness just after being admitted, but this reaction quickly faded as they became accustomed to the environment. The normal behavior demonstrated by the phony patients while in the psychiatric hospital was confirmed by the notes that nurses routinely take of the patients. However, the false symptoms the pseudopatients described to gain admission into the psychiatric facility resulted in the phony patients being labeled as schizophrenics. Just about everything the pseudopatients did or said were erroneously interpreted as a sign of mental illness, especially as a sign of schizophrenia. That is, the staff in effect was misinterpreting much of what they observed in terms of the label schizophrenic. When the phony patients were observed taking notes, it was interpreted as part of their illness by the staff. When the pseudopatients were interviewed by psychiatrists, the interpretation of their history and their past interactions with relatives were interpreted according to the label schizophrenic. It is interesting to note that the real patients were suspicious of the pseudopatients, because the pseudopatients were taking a large amount of notes, suggesting that they were doing a study. Most likely the real patients did not know that the pseudopatients were labeled schizophrenics, or if they did, they were not responding to the label. Thus they interpreted the note-taking as some type of normal behavior. The real patients accused the pseudopatients of being journalists or professors checking up on the hospital. The Sutta patients assured them that they were real patients. They explained that they were sick when they entered the hospital, and they explained further that they were fine now. Thus, the real patients were not influenced by labels, but the staff was so influenced because they knew of the label. Another factor that may have contributed to the erroneous conclusions of the staff is the time spent with patients was rather limited. When people have little time to make an evaluation, they are more likely to respond to the prejudicial beliefs that are often associated with labels. In addition, time limitations can prevent an evaluator, such as a psychiatrist, from accurately analyzing and evaluating the behavior and verbal responses from the patient. The inability to analyze and evaluate, because of time limitations, can result in being influenced by means of the suggestive influence of a label. The real patients spend more time with the Sutta patients than the hospital staff did, and this may have been the reason that the patients were more accurate in their assessments. The Sutta patients were even given medicine as a result of the label schizophrenic or mentally ill. This medication included Plavil, Stelazine, Compazine, Thorazine and other medications. Nearly 2,100 pills were given to the phony patients. However, only two of these pills were swallowed and the remainder were secretly disposed of. The response of the hospital staff to the phony patients was not unique to a specific institution. Rosenhan carried out the experiment described above in 12 hospitals throughout the United States. This involved hospitals on the East and West Coast in 5 different states. The hospitals ranged from new to old, from research-oriented to a non-research orientation, from good staff-to-patient ratios to poor staff-to-patient ratios. There were 8 Sutta patients involved in the experiment. The average stay at the hospital was 19 days. The range was from 7 to 52 days. The time interval of the hospitalization should have been more than ample time to determine that the patients did not have a serious mental disorder. Keep in mind that once they were admitted, they behaved in a totally normal way. The only abnormality was presented during admission, which was only a claim of hearing voices, which was empty, hollow and thud and nothing more. These phony patients did not suggest suicide or any other destructive actions at any point during the experiment. The Sutta patients had no psychiatric history and were psychologically normal people. 4 of these individuals were mental health professionals themselves, specifically one was a psychiatrist and 3 were psychologists. These individuals did not reveal their true occupation to the staff at the hospital because it may have interfered with the experiment. The other Sutta patients were involved in respectable endeavors and roles in society, which was a graduate student in psychology, a pediatrician, a housewife and a painter. 5 of the phony patients were male and 3 were female. Thus, there certainly were nothing unusual or abnormal about these individuals. And there apparently was no logical reason for the diagnosis that they were discharged with, which was schizophrenia in remission. The experiment did reveal valuable information, and it met the primary purpose of the research, which was basically to see if the mentally ill can be distinguished from normal people by mental health professionals. The idea was also to determine to what extent mental disorders are in the minds of the observer or within the individual designated mentally ill. That is, a major question the researchers were interested in was to determine to what extent is mental disorders the result of the context and the observer as opposed to an abnormality within the patient. The exact words used by the experimenter are at its heart, the question of whether the sane can be distinguished from the insane and whether degrees of insanity can be distinguished from each other is a simple matter. Do the salient characteristics that lead to diagnoses reside in the patients themselves or in the environments and contexts in which observers find them? The results of the research clearly indicated that the observers within a specific environmental context can result in the diagnosis of a mental disorder. This is essentially the same as saying that the disorder was the result of the observers and the environment, which was certainly true under the experimental conditions. However, this experiment did not prove that this is the case with all mental disorders. It just proved that it is possible that the diagnosis of a mental disorder could be the result of irrational evaluations of observers within an environment under some conditions. A reasonable conclusion can be determined if the possible causes of a mental disorder are analyzed as follows: 1. Biological causes, such as abnormal biochemistry affecting the central nervous system, or damage to various portions of the brain. Two psychological causes, such as maladaptive learning, thinking and behavior. Three social factors, such as the evaluations of the people within an environment of an individual, which could be based on observations of behavior that is perceived to be abnormal according to social norms, or it could be the result of irrational thinking on the part of the evaluators, such as responding to prejudicial beliefs or to a label. If we examine the literature of just about any psychology text, it appears that there are some mental disorders that involve 1, 2, and 3. However, most mental disorders probably only involve 2 and 3 as significant factors. There are, of course, mental conditions that only annoy the individual with the disorder. The manifestations of such conditions may not be observed by others and may only involve 2 psychological causes. There can also be mental conditions that only involve 1 biological causes, such as a case of very mild senility, which may not have any significant social consequences under certain conditions. And there are most likely cases that involve only 3 social factors, as was proved possible by the Rosenhan research. Thus, it is unreasonable to conclude based on the Rosenhan research that all mental disorders are the result of social factors, such as prejudicial beliefs or an irrational evaluation based on a label. A reasonable conclusion is that some mental disorders might be worsened by prejudicial beliefs associated with the label. In addition, there might be some mental disorders that are solely the result of a label. This can happen when an individual suffered a stressful experience that was mistakenly diagnosed as a major mental disorder, resulting in a label that causes others to misinterpret and respond negatively to the labeled individual. Such incorrect diagnoses might happen when people in the environment do not understand the stressful circumstances that the patient experienced. Another possibility can be found when an individual had a psychiatric condition and recovered, but the label from the condition may persist in the minds of the patient's doctors, family and friends, with the belief that the label is still an accurate representation of the mental state of the patient. This thinking can also involve the idea that the patient is still mentally ill but her illness is in a temporary state of remission. Any of the circumstances described in the above paragraph can result in misinterpretation of the patient's actions and negative evaluations and treatment of the labeled individual. In such cases, the labeled individual may be inadvertently forced or coaxed into a role of a mental patient for many years or even for life. This can involve the patient truly believing that the diagnostic label is a valid representation of her mental condition. Even when the patient does not agree with the accuracy of the diagnostic label, she may learn to accept the label and play the role of a mental patient because there may be some rewards in doing so, such as receiving acceptance from therapists, receiving sympathy from her family, obtaining prescription drugs, and receiving disability benefits. There also may be some penalties inflicted inadvertently if the patient does not accept her status as indicated by the psychiatric diagnostic label. Such penalties can involve criticisms and other negative treatment based on the belief that the patient is not psychologically stable enough to accept reality in relation to her psychiatric disorder. There is additional information and conclusions from the results of Rosenhan's research, which are discussed in the following two paragraphs. The inability of mental health professionals to distinguish sane from the insane was experimentally tested in a way that was quite different from the first set of experiments. In the later experiments, the staff of a psychiatric hospital were told that phony patients would be admitted, and their job was to see if they could spot them. In reality, no phony patients were admitted, but the staff found many patients that they believed might be phony, that is, normal. Keep in mind that these patients believed to be phony were real patients. Thus, the results of Rosenhan's research certainly indicate that mental health professionals in psychiatric hospitals may not be able to distinguish the sane from the insane. They appear to be influenced by the social component of labels, which is the case with most people in our modern society. The influential impact from the labels in the first experiment was so strong that the psychiatrists prescribed medication for the pseudopatients, as already explained. Thus, it is reasonable to conclude that real patients may sometimes be given inappropriate or unnecessary medication as a result of a label. It is also reasonable to conclude that sometimes patients may be confined in psychiatric hospitals unnecessarily as a result of a label. Of course, The opposite is also true in some cases. That is, mental patients may be inappropriately discharged from psychiatric hospitals, which can result in the patient living on the street or hurting herself or harming another individual. This certainly suggests that there is a difficulty in distinguishing relative degrees of sanity from insanity. That is, sometimes psychiatric patients are mistakenly considered mentally stable enough to be released from a psychiatric hospital, but in reality they are in effect quite insane, and cannot function satisfactorily outside of a psychiatric facility. There are many possible criticisms that can be aimed at the research and conclusions of D.L. Rosenhan, but every argument I have heard or can think of fails. The most obvious criticism can be based on the fact that the pseudo-patients applied for admission in a psychiatric hospital complaining that they were hearing voices, a symptom of schizophrenia. One can argue that the phony patients fooled the psychiatrists. However, this argument fails, because the pseudo-patients only said that they heard voices, which was minimized to only three words, empty, hollow and thud. This could be the result of many conditions, such as lack of sleep or some unknown minor disturbance, but the diagnosis that they were discharged with was schizophrenia in remission. If we compare the pseudo-patient's phony symptoms with other branches of medicine, we can see an interesting difference. Most of us at one time or another had a false symptom of a major disease or know someone who did. Common examples of false symptoms are a lump that looks like cancer or a pain in the chest that seems to be a heart problem. Such false symptoms are usually quickly diagnosed as insignificant problems, after a very short period of medical evaluation. They usually do not hospitalize people with such false symptoms, and if they do, it is for a short period of testing, which usually is less than 2 or 3 days. Compare this short stay with the length of time the pseudo-patients had to stay at the psychiatric hospital, which was an average of 19 days, with a range from 7 to 52 days. There is a difference between the person with the false medical symptom and the pseudo-patients in the experiment. This difference is people who have medical symptoms are not labeled, they are tested. For example, no physician would label a person a cancer patient if the patient simply has a lump. After a period of careful testing, such a patient might be scientifically diagnosed and labeled. Doctors are cautious about applying labels that relate to medical conditions because there are consequences to such labeling. There can be even greater consequences to a psychiatric diagnostic label, but cautiousness in labeling does not appear to be present, if Rosenhan's research results are typical of psychiatric hospitals. What happened in the experiment is the pseudo-patients were labeled based on a false symptom, without any attempt at a scientific evaluation. Once the pseudo-patients were labeled, the suggestive influence of the label guided the thinking, perceptions and evaluations of the staff in relation to the phony patients. There is no valid scientific reason why the false symptoms that Rosenhan's pseudo-patients presented to the staff of the psychiatric hospitals should have not been recognized. A mental health professional responding in a logical way would first determine if the patient was at risk of intentionally or unintentionally harming herself or another individual, or if there was a potential risk that the patient would destroy property or violate the law in some way. The next step would be to look for other symptoms of schizophrenia or of mental instability, which was not present in the pseudo-patients. Since these phony patients only were instructed to say they were hearing voices, the logical conclusion should have been they do not have a mental disorder that requires hospitalization. However, it is probably not easy for anyone, even a mental health professional, to react totally logically when evaluating people who violate cultural norms. We live in a society where people do not hear voices, or if they do, they do not talk about it. And if they do talk about hearing voices, they must be mentally ill or schizophrenic according to our normative system. If we accept the fact that there may be some culturally based superstition involved with certain aspects of psychiatric diagnostic labels, and that the hospital staff was probably influenced by such a label, the reason for the incorrect diagnoses is clarified. One can conclude from the research and from many other sources that much of the concept of mental illness is culturally based. That is, our culture has certain concepts on what constitutes schizophrenia and we have a label for it. When we detect certain symptoms, the belief is that the patient is schizophrenic. And the irrational reverse also may hold true in many contexts, as suggested by the research. That is, when we see a person labeled schizophrenic, we perceive symptoms associated with the patient, whether the symptoms exist in reality or not. The counter-argument to the idea that many mental disorders are culturally based is as follows. In extreme cases of mental illness, such as an individual that is totally mad, insane and irrational, or severely mentally retarded, there will be universal agreement in all cultures that the individual is mentally ill or mentally dysfunctional. Although this is true, the argument fails for the following reasons. Such extreme cases are moderately rare and do not generally apply to most individuals labeled mentally ill. Obviously, it did not apply to the phony patients in the Rosenhan experiments. This research and the resulting article were not dealing with the extreme cases of mental dysfunction. Rosenhan's study was dealing with the more common situations found in mental hospitals and psychiatric clinics. That is, most psychiatric patients are fairly rational in most respects, and the irrational components of their thinking and behavior can often be seen as culturally based, and nothing more. For example, if an individual is faced with extreme failure and loss in some cultures, suicide might be considered a rational choice to avoid further unpleasant consequences and suffering. However, in our society, such an individual would be diagnosed as having clinical depression. This might be quite functional, if we succeed in preventing the suicide, but it is important to realize that the diagnosis is not a medical one. It is a culturally based assessment. This is probably true to some extent with most, but not all, psychiatric diagnoses. Another interesting experiment that shows the effect of the social component of labels was mentioned by Rosenhan in his article, and was carried out in a medical school. A young woman stopped people and asked directions to the clinic, indicating that she was looking for either an internist or a psychiatrist. When she indicated that she was looking for an internist, she got more cooperation than when she stated she was looking for a psychiatrist. The request for assistance to find a psychiatrist in effect resulted in a labeling process, where the young woman was labeled mentally ill, by the individuals she spoke to for information. The label of mentally ill probably resulted in anxiety and irrational concerns in the minds of the people she asked for help, which resulted in less cooperation than when she asked for help to find an internist. The information and conclusions discussed about psychiatric labels in this section can be reinforced and amplified by the addition of the basic ideas of Dr. Thomas S. Shash. The following 10 points in quotation marks are from Dr. Shash's book The Myth of Mental Illness Revised Edition, 1974. 1. Strictly speaking, disease or illness can affect only the body. Hence, there can be no mental illness. The term mental illness is deceiving, because most mental illnesses are not diseases, in the sense of an affliction of the body. Mental disorders are usually caused by psychological and social factors. Generally, such disorders consist of thinking and behavior that is considered abnormal, and there is no biological cause for the condition. However, there are many mental health professionals that prefer to believe that there is a biological cause to psychiatric disorders. Their view is that the abnormal condition is a biological weakness that was triggered by environmental stresses. This view is advocated by drug companies because it serves as a justification for administering medication. Such a view may also be supported by some psychiatric patients and their families, because it allows them to escape the responsibility for their maladaptive thinking and behavior. 2. Mental illness is a metaphor. Minds can be sick only in the sense that jokes are sick or economies are sick. The term mental illness is not literal or scientific terminology. In reality, the individual's behavior may be considered inappropriate or dysfunctional by others, and might be classified as a mental illness. In addition, there are obviously people that consider their own thinking, behavior and life situation as a mental disorder, which is not a biological illness. Thus, the concept of mental illness is deceiving. In general, most mental illnesses can be more accurately classified as psychological or psychiatric disorders. Specifically, these disorders are not biological in nature, they are manifestations of thinking and behavior. Of course, thinking and behavior can have biological consequences, such as a person that drinks excessive quantities of alcohol or takes drugs. Other examples are emotional stress or depression can have a negative biological impact on the body. However, it is important to realize that the causes of such conditions are generally psychological in nature. There are mental health professionals and patients that prefer to believe that there is an inborn biological predisposition for such conditions. I believe this is a rationalization in most cases, which allows all concerned to escape responsibility for inappropriate behavior. It is easy to support this type of rationalization by studying family histories and individuals from similar cultures and subcultures, which can falsely suggest that there is a biological predisposition leading to psychological and psychiatric disorders. In some cases, there really may be such a biological connection, but generally this belief is probably quite false. Psychological and psychiatric disorders are essentially thinking and behavior patterns that are learned, and such learning can be learned from family members, from a culture and from a subculture. 3. Psychiatric diagnoses are stigmatizing labels, phrased to resemble medical diagnosis and applied to persons whose behavior annoys or offends others. The labels used by psychiatrists to label their patients are often deceiving. In addition, such labels give a false impression of a medical condition. In reality, the psychiatric patient is labeled because he is displaying behavior that other people find annoying or offensive. Basically, such behavior violates the norms of society, and thus the individual is considered mentally ill and is labeled with a psychiatric diagnostic label. I would add, some people have thinking, behavior patterns, nervous reactions or general life problems, which only bother them and nobody else. Such individuals may seek the treatment of a psychologist or psychiatrist and thus receive a diagnostic label. Dr. Shash's point about psychiatric labels being stigmatizing is reinforced by the model of labeling presented in this text and Rosenhan's research. 4. Those who suffered from and complain of their own behavior are usually classified as neurotic. Those whose behavior makes others suffer, and about whom others complain, are usually classified as psychotic. This point is quite clear, but I believe that there are many exceptions, which Dr. Shash probably realized, because he used the word usually. There are many cases where an individual classified as a neurotic bothers others. This can be especially true if the individual is in an authority position, such as a parent, a boss, a supervisor or a professor. In addition, there may be some individuals that are classified as psychotic, who are very withdrawn, and do not interact with others, and bother nobody. However, generally, an individual that displays behavior that is considered very strange and bothers others, will probably be classified as psychotic. This may be even more likely if the individual is in a low power position, such as an individual that is poor. And most people that are discontented with their own lives and behavior would most likely be classified as neurotic, as opposed to psychotic. This would probably be even more likely if they are in a high power position. 5. Mental illness is not something a person has, but is something he does or is. The point is that what is generally called mental illness is the result of an ongoing pattern of abnormal behavior, which is more or less intentionally carried out by the individual. If the individual did not display such abnormal behavior, he would not be classified and labeled as mentally ill. People may say such an individual is a schizophrenic, is neurotic, is crazy, etc. 6. If there is no mental illness, there can be no hospitalization, treatment, or cure for it. Of course, people may change their behavior or personality, with or without psychiatric intervention. Such intervention is nowadays called treatment, and the change, if it proceeds in a direction approved by society, recovery or cure. The point is that what is called mental illness is abnormal behavior and it does not make sense to cure behavior. Hospitals and the philosophy that prevails in such facilities are centered around treating disease, and abnormal behavior is not a disease. In addition, behavior and personality can be changed by the individual with or without help from a psychiatrist. If there is an improvement in behavior or personality, especially if it resulted from psychiatric intervention, it may be considered a recovery or a cure. However, such terms recovery, cure are inappropriate and deceiving. Nobody can cure behavior or personality, but it can be changed or improved. 7. The introduction of psychiatric considerations into the administration of the criminal law, for example, the insanity plea and verdict, diagnosis of mental incompetence to stand trial, and so forth, corrupt the law and victimize the subject on whose behalf they are ostensibly employed. The point is, psychiatric diagnostic labels and related philosophy are dysfunctional in relation to the legal system. The defense can always claim insanity and support the plea with the help of a well-paid psychiatrist and lawyer. The prosecution will claim that the suspect is sane, which will also be supported by a well-paid psychiatrist. In addition, the process is quite irrational and it appears to be based on superstitious beliefs about abnormal behavior. An individual that intentionally carries out a relatively complex criminal act obviously is aware of what he is doing. The fact that their personality and behavior may be abnormal and irrational does not justify a lighter sentence. It justifies a longer incarceration time, because such an individual is usually somewhat unpredictable and may be difficult or impossible to rehabilitate. 8. Personal conduct is always rule-following, strategic, and meaningful. Patterns of interpersonal and social relations may be regarded and analyzed as if they were games, the behavior of the players being governed by explicit or tacit game rules. The basic idea is that human behavior, especially when it involves interaction with others, can be conceptualized and studied as if it is a set of games. A normal person plays games that are not offensive to others, and the game rules he follows are accepted by society as proper. An individual that is considered mentally ill plays games that are offensive to others, and he follows rules that are not accepted by society. I will add that normal people are more likely to play functional games, and individuals with mental disorders are more likely to play dysfunctional games. Perhaps a better and more accurate term than games would be strategies. That is, human beings learn, develop, and use strategies to satisfy their emotional needs and obtain the things they want in life. Some people use functional and rational strategies that are acceptable by society. These people are labeled normal or sane. People that have been labeled mentally ill were probably so labeled because they use dysfunctional and/or irrational strategies that are not acceptable by society. 9. In most types of voluntary psychotherapy, the therapist tries to elucidate the inexplicit game rules by which the client conducts himself, and to help the client scrutinize the goals and values of the life games he plays. A psychotherapist can analyze the games that an individual plays and make the client more aware of the games and its relative degree of dysfunctionality, with the goal of helping the client develop more functional strategies. 10. There is no medical, moral, or legal justification for involuntary psychiatric interventions. They are crimes against humanity. I believe this statement is certainly true sometimes. No doubt, there have been people who have been misdiagnosed and labeled and kept in mental hospitals. The Rosenhans research suggests just how this could happen. An individual that is quite functional, harmless, and somewhat unusual in his communication style and behavior could easily be misdiagnosed and labeled as mentally ill and confined to a mental hospital. Such an individual may be given inappropriate medication for a disorder that does not exist. However, I believe just the opposite is sometimes true. That is, there are cases where it is immoral, cruel, and irrational not to confine certain individuals to a mental hospital or some other psychiatric facility. There are people who simply cannot function in our society. If they are not institutionalized, they may well sleep on the streets and not be able to take care of their basic survival needs. Such individuals are likely to suffer from malnutrition and other medical problems because of their inability to take care of themselves. In the winter, such individuals may freeze to death on the city streets. Some of these people are alcoholics or drug addicts, and if they survive the winter months, they may sooner or later die from their addiction. It is immoral not to institutionalize such people. Another situation where it is morally justified to institutionalize an individual against her will is when the individual is obviously dangerous to others or to herself. I believe, after discussing the Rosenhans research, Dr. Thomas Southshash views and other ideas dealing with the dysfunctional aspects of psychiatric diagnostic labels, it is necessary to give a complete picture of these labels. Psychiatric diagnostic labels are not always dysfunctional. Unlike the phony patients in the Rosenhan's research, real patients usually have real problems. However, the problems are usually not caused by any physiological disease. The problems are generally the result of dysfunctional psychological and social factors, which do not make them necessarily any less severe than difficulties caused by abnormal physiology. Such problems can have an adverse impact on the body in some cases and cause physiological malfunctions. The most dramatic examples of this are seen in people addicted to drugs. Psychiatric diagnostic labels might guide some individuals toward proper treatment for their condition. The diagnostic labels can serve to obtain justified and needed assistance from insurance, government agencies, and other sources. The psychiatric labels can also sometimes serve to explain a patient's inability to behave normally and to perform certain tasks in a normal way. Psychiatric labels can be used in a more functional way if we accept the fact that they are part of a classification system that is very rough and approximate in nature. These labels only represent a precise set of symptoms in textbooks and articles on psychology and psychiatry. It is also necessary to realize that these labels designate dysfunctional thinking and behavior patterns, which are not biologically based diseases, with some exceptions. There are many erroneous ideas connected to these labels. If we keep the above in mind, we can deal with the labels and the people that were labeled with psychiatric diagnosis in a more functional way. Note, there are many mental health professionals that would disagree with all of the above. They believe that psychiatric diagnostic labels represent fairly precise diagnostic labels of biologically based diseases that affect behavior and thinking. Psychiatric diagnostic labels are often used in scientific research as well as in clinical work as if they were precise labels. This, of course, is likely to result in faulty research and inappropriate clinical treatment. The alternative to using such labels is to describe the patient's history and current problems in written language. For example, if a hypothetical individual named Harry is suffering from major depression, the condition might be described as follows. Note, this hypothetical history is simplified for the purpose of brevity and ease of comprehension. A real case history should contain a little more detail, such as dates, the age of the people involved, the length of time that various situations lasted, etc. End of note. Harry never had any diagnosed psychiatric difficulties until recently. The factors that appeared to have led to his current condition started when he was having difficulties with his business, which eventually led to a bankruptcy. This failure and the related financial problems led to conflict with his wife. Harry tried to resolve his financial difficulties by obtaining employment. This effort lasted 3 months and led to failure. Because of the financial problems, Harry could not pay his mortgage, which led to a foreclosure on his house. This led to severe conflicts with his wife, who eventually filed for divorce. After the divorce, Harry moved into a small apartment and was still unemployed, and was obtaining some financial assistance from his parents. He was not sleeping or eating well because of emotional stress that resulted from the above problems. This led to a depletion of energy and drive, which made the problems even harder to deal with. Thus, he totally gave up trying to rectify his financial difficulties. At this point in time, he had an argument with his parents over the financial assistance they were providing. During this argument, Harry threatened suicide, which led to his hospitalization. The above description reveals much more than the label major depression. There are people who would be labeled with major depression that have a very different set of problems than Harry. Some individuals who are labeled as having major depression may have a history of using ineffective strategies that lead to failures. Such individuals may also have inadequate coping strategies to deal with their failures. This was not the case with our hypothetical Harry. Thus, descriptions are more precise than psychiatric diagnostic labels, which can disguise the real causes for psychiatric disorders. The description of Harry's problems indicates a series of causes, where one problem caused another, which may be found in many patients classified with psychiatric diagnostic labels. By looking at the description, we know that Harry is not really sick, but we certainly do not want him to commit suicide. Thus, People like our hypothetical Harry need much help to overcome their problems. In general, by understanding the set of problems and the true causes of a psychiatric condition, it is possible to provide much better assistance for the troubled individual. In addition, by understanding the true dynamics causing such problems, it will reduce the proliferation of erroneous interpretations of research results and misconceptions about psychiatric disorders. Part 6: The Social Psychological Component and Related Ideas. The social psychological component is the most complicated of the four primary components of a label. It is difficult to define this concept, in a clear way, in a single sentence. The simplest definition is as follows. The social psychological component is the psychological impact of the social component on the labeled individual. This can essentially be thought of as the psychological influence and effect of the feedback stemming from the label, as the labeled individual perceives it. The word feedback means here the responses of other people, as the labeled individual senses and interprets the responses. Below there is a more complex and detailed definition, involving one long paragraph. Note the words that are double underlined in the following paragraph have special meaning, which will be defined within the paragraph. The social psychological component is the psychological impact on the individual that results from the way other people respond to the individual's label. The impact is the influence and/or results, which can be direct or indirect in nature. Direct means as a direct result of the way people respond. Indirect means as an indirect result of the way people respond. For example, if an individual is labeled as mentally ill and lives in a small town, where everyone knows each other's business, he may not be able to find employment. This will have a direct psychological impact on the individual. The poverty that results from the inability to obtain employment in this example is an indirect impact of the label, mentally ill. The word impact is the psychological effect and result. This is the labeled individual's responses and adjustments, which are the result of the way people respond to the individual as a consequence of the label. The adjustments are both short and long term and could be either functional or dysfunctional, and can include the roles the individual takes on, the roles the individual avoids, the way the individual deals with problems and life in general. The words respond to in the definition and explanations appear to have an obvious meaning, but a clarification is very necessary. The words mean as the individual perceives the way others respond to him or her. That is, the perception of the labeled individual is a primary factor in the social psychological component of a label. This is the case whether the perception is accurate or not. For example, an individual that is accurately labeled as very severely retarded will probably not be capable of perceiving the true social reactions of people to his condition. Thus, the social psychological component may have very little impact in such cases. At the other extreme, some people may falsely perceive mistreatment and prejudicial responses as a result of their label. However, even though the perceptions may not be reality-based, the psychological effect and results may be the same, or almost the same, as if the perceptions were reality-based. In actual situations, people usually do truly to act in more or less moderately precise ways to the way individuals are labeled. Thus, the perception of the labeled individual is usually, but not always, the result of reality or reality with some perceptional distortions mixed in. As with the other components of a label, the model I am presenting in this text does not reveal the actual social psychological component of a specific label. The model just predicts that all labels applied to human beings have a social psychological component, with an impact that can range in strength from very great to zero. Very great means, of course, that there is a very significant social psychological impact from the label. And zero means there is no social psychological impact from the label. Thus, the following examples of the social psychological component should be considered either as good guesses or hypothetical examples. The label intelligent was used to illustrate the psychological and social components. Intelligent is also a good label to illustrate the social psychological component. If an individual is labeled intelligent and does fairly well academically, the feedback he is likely to get from others will probably be positive, which will have an overall positive impact on the individual's mental state. Such an individual is likely to be encouraged by others in intellectual and academic areas. This encouragement will usually motivate the individual to invest time and effort in developing his intelligence. If such an individual is a child or a teenager, and does not make an investment in time and effort to develop his intelligence, the result might be punishment from instructors and parents. Thus, the person who has been labeled intelligent will probably be rewarded most of the time for behaving intelligently and punished for behaving unintelligently, which would probably persuade such an individual to behave according to his label. An example that is similar to the above can be presented from the negative label unintelligent. The person labeled unintelligent will probably be inadvertently coaxed into a mental state and behavior pattern that reflects low intelligence. Such an individual will probably not receive much encouragement from others to perform well academically or intellectually. If such an individual is a child or teenager, his instructors and parents would probably not punish him for not doing well in school. The individual with the label unintelligent might simply learn to behave according to his label. A general principle can be seen from the above and throughout this paper, which is that labels often produce a self-fulfilling prophecy. The social psychological component is usually a primary part of such a self-fulfilling prophecy. Specifically, the reactions of others can affect the labeled individual's thinking and behavior in such a way as to make the individual's label accurate. This can happen in some cases even if the label originally was totally inaccurate. The above can be summed up with the following generalization. People have a tendency to intentionally or inadvertently persuade the labeled individual to behave according to his or her label. The word tendency is used because the above is not an absolute reality. There are situations where people will probably do just the opposite. For example, counselors and social workers might intentionally coax an individual to think and behave in a way that is just the opposite of a negative label, such as a juvenile delinquent in a good rehabilitation facility. In general, the social psychological component has a tendency, which is not absolute, to influence the labeled individual to behave according to his or her label. For example, a person labeled police officer will get feedback from his superiors that will persuade the individual to behave according to his proper role. Some of this feedback can be of an official nature. That is, the superiors may see that the labeled individual follows formal rules as dictated by his label. The individual will also get informal feedback from others that will influence him toward the behavior dictated by his label. The police officer will be treated like a police officer by his fellow workers and by the public. This will influence the police officer to behave like a policeman or policewoman. An important principle is suggested from the above paragraph, which is there are different formal and/or informal rules for each type of label. Some examples will clarify the above. Obviously, there are many formal rules for the person labeled police officer. Such an individual must carry a gun, must patrol certain areas, must respond to emergencies, must observe and enforce the law, etc. However, there are also informal rules for the individual labeled police officer. He is expected to behave in a certain way by his co-workers and the general public. His co-workers might expect him not to report misconduct by other police officers, such as a police officer using excessive force to make an arrest. Occasionally, informal rules violate formal rules, such as in the above example. There are also expectations associated with labels that do not fall under the category of either formal or informal rules. These expectations can be very subtle in some cases and can sometimes be difficult to describe, partly because they may not be defined in any verbal terms. Some examples are we expect a mental patient to behave like a mental patient, we expect an unsupervised criminal to behave like a criminal, we expect an intelligent person to behave intelligently, an unintelligent individual to behave unintelligently. A more subtle example of expectations can relate to body language that is related to a label. For example, we expect a person labeled police officer to present a certain type of body language, such as facial expressions, posture, positioning of arms, etc. This can become obvious if a police officer displays a body language that deviates from the expectations. To make this obvious to yourself, think of a police officer presenting the body language of a receptionist, a waitress, or a dancer. The point is basically, we expect people to behave according to their label even when the label is a negative one. For example, if a person labeled mental patient behaves in a normal way, people might think he is trying to hide his mental illness. Perhaps the patient might be accused of behaving normally to be released from a mental hospital. This or a similar response from others might anger, frustrate, or depress the patient in such a way that the patient is acting mentally ill once again. The point of the above three paragraphs, from the perspective of the social psychological components of labels, are that the formal rules, informal rules, and expectations are factors that other people intentionally or inadvertently use to guide the behavior of the labeled individual. This can be functional or dysfunctional depending on the circumstances and the label. We want the police officer to live up to his label, but we do not want the mental patient to live up to his label. Obviously, in the case of the police officer, most of the controlling feedback is generally functional. However, in the case of the mental patient, such feedback can be quite dysfunctional, because it maintains the dysfunctional emotional responses and behavior of the patient. The above principle probably is important for most negative labels and it can be summarized as follows. Society often, but not always, inadvertently treats people with negative labels in such a way as to make the label correct. If the individual deviates from the label, he may get feedback that consciously or unconsciously influences him to behave according to the label. Some of this tendency can be seen from Rosenhan's research, which is explained in the following paragraph. The phony patients in Rosenhan's experiments were treated as though they were incompetent and insane, even though they were perfectly normal. The phony patients did not respond in a very significant way to this treatment, because they were aware that they were participating in an experiment. If the pseudo patients thought they were real patients, the treatment they received would have probably had a significant psychological impact on their thinking and behavior. They most likely would have been quite frightened, nervous, angry, depressed and defensive, which can certainly be interpreted or misinterpreted as a mental illness or psychiatric disorder. This would most likely result in more severe treatment from the staff of the psychiatric hospital, which can include a longer hospital stay, more medication, shock therapy, a worse diagnosis, and even more treatment as an incompetent individual. This could worsen the mental state of the individuals even further, which could result in one or more of the following: a general anxiety, eating difficulties, an inability to sleep adequately, a tendency to sleep excessively, depression or an increase in the level of depression, an increase in the level of anger, and possibly aggressive verbal remarks hurled at the staff. This, of course, would result in even worse treatment by the staff, which would worsen the mental state of the hospitalized individuals. Eventually, the hospitalized individuals would most likely accept the label mental patient and the psychiatric diagnostic label applied to them. At that point, they might adjust to their status as mentally ill individuals, which would probably result in some reduction of the above symptoms. The doctors would most likely interpret the results as an improvement, which would eventually result in a release from the mental hospital. Something very similar to the above is probably involved with most real mental patients to some degree. Although portions of the above are somewhat hypothetical, it illustrates two very important principles about the social psychological component of labels. Labels can cause self-fulfilling prophecies, which was already discussed, and vicious cycles. The vicious cycle can be described as follows. The individual is treated in a certain way by other people because of his label, which might be either positive functional or negative dysfunctional. The thinking and behavior of the individual is influenced toward a specific direction by the treatment he receives from others, such as positive or negative. I will use negative to illustrate a principle further. The negative behavior that results from the above influences others to treat the labeled individual in an even more negative way. This even more negative treatment can worsen the individual's thinking and behavior. Then the worsened behavior results in other people treating the individual even more negatively. This can repeat continuously in a series of cycles, worsening a problem. Keep in mind, as indicated above, such a cycle can also go in a positive direction, where constructive and positive behavior is reinforced in a series of cycles. Perhaps the word vicious is not appropriate in the terminology, when the cycle is positive, but nevertheless there can be a positive cyclic sequence that produces an increasingly successful and functional situation. Being aware that a label can sometimes cause a self-fulfilling prophecies, and or a vicious cycle, can be quite useful. Such an awareness or insight might be useful in preventing a negative self-fulfilling prophecy from developing. It might also be useful in preventing or stopping a negative vicious cycle. And just the opposite may also be true. The insight might be useful in creating positive versions of self-fulfilling prophecies and vicious cycles that go in a constructive direction.